so to start off today, we're very happy to have Tim Hollywood, who will tell us about Azalea Constraints and the LightCon.
So thank you very much. So thanks very much to the organizers for arranging this meeting. I'm very pleased to be speaking about some work that I've been doing off and on for the last few years with Graham Shaw. And it does have something to tell us maybe about causality constraints in more general situations. So I want to shed some light, hopefully some subluminal light, and address this question that we were talking about yesterday. So I want to pick up on some of the nice discussions that we were having. So is superluminal propagation in some effective field theory in a non-trivial background pathological? Does that rule out a consistent UV completion? And the answer can't be yes always, because there's a counterexample. And that's what I want to discuss today. And that's just QED in curved space-time, which of course is definitely UV complete, well, at least in perturbation theory. This is not an issue to do with the Landau pole. And it's perfectly causal.
And also subluminal. I mean, luminal at most.
Let's get there. So the question is, how does it manage to have superluminal propagation in the effective theory when we integrate out the electron and yet still be perfectly causal and UV complete? And this is a story of causality violation, if you like, which has a nice clean ending. Which we've only really realized fairly recently. So this is, the sort of punchline is not published. So what are we talking about? Well, the effect we're talking about for QED is vacuum polarization in curved space. So we're interested in the propagation of photons, and this is affected, of course, by vacuum polarization, so this one-loop diagram. And the fact is this one-loop diagram has some scale associated with it. It's an extended object, and so it's sensitive to the curvature of the background. And that's encoded in the polarization tensor, which in real space, so X and X prime are the vertices, it's just a product of the propagators of the electron and the positron with a suitable trace and some gamma matrices. And the point is the vacuum polarization, this effect, when we look at it from the point of view of the low energy effective theory, where we expand in inverse powers of the electron mass, generates terms, so this of course is the Maxwell term, but generates terms beyond that that depend on powers of the curvature and derivatives. So these are the terms that we're going to focus on. And it was shown a long time ago in 1980 by Drummond and Hatherell that if we look at the first two terms, the ones that are linear in the curvature, so the first corrections, so if we focus on these two terms, they calculated them, there are two possible terms, one involving the Ricci tensor, one involving the Riemann tensor, like that. And we think about photon propagation with these terms there, then we find what appears to be superluminal propagation. So kind of let me explain this a bit more detail. So first of all, think about the case where we just have the Maxwell term. Of course, this is in curved space, so things are not so easy even then. So we're going to work in the so-called geometric optics limit, where the frequency of the photon wave mode that we're looking at is a lot greater than the curvature scale, so the square root of this curvature scale R. And so we can think about this propagation in two ways in the geometric optics limit. We can think about it as a wave, so there are wave fronts. So our mode here can be written in terms of some adapted coordinates. So V is the coordinate that appears up here in the phase. So these wave fronts have V equals constant. And then the other way of thinking about the propagation in this limit is in terms of rays or congruences of null geodesics. So these I've shown here as the lines. And what I'm going to do, so there's another adapted coordinate U, another null coordinate, which is the affine parameter along these null geodesics. And then I've got two transverse coordinates, these yi's, I runs from 1 to 2, which are the coordinates, transverse coordinates or the coordinates along the wavefronts. So that's the picture of geometric optics. We can think about the propagation two ways, in terms of the wave picture or in terms of the null geodesics. Now, the Drummond-Hatherell terms will have an effect on this propagation. So let's focus on one particular ray. Let's pick out one null geodesic, the one with V equals some constant, those transverse coordinates Y being zero, which we can, that's just a choice, and then U varying. U is the affine parameter. And if we think about the equation of motion in the presence of those two extra Drummond-Hatherell terms, then the mode for the photon gets a correction, which we write up in the exponent like this. It's this phase theta. And it depends on where we are along our geodesic. And we can write it as an integral of what amounts to the refractive index, well, the refractive index minus one. The reason why we can do that is because this effect is perturbatively small. Okay, so this refractive index, of course, it depends on the frequency. It's the inverse of the phase velocity, but it also, sometimes I'll show it explicitly and sometimes it's just implicit. It depends on where you are along the geodesic. So it's a kind of local quantity in that sense. So this is the quantity we're going to focus on, and this is what gets affected by the Drummond-Hatherell terms. So we have, of course, the term that we get from just the Maxwell term in the action, but then there's the Drummond-Hatherell correction, which can be written in terms of the Ricci and Riemann tensor components. I and J run 1 to 2. Those are those two transverse coordinates. And it's very easy to show that at least one of the polarizations is superluminal if the null energy condition is satisfied by the background.
Can I ask you to relate to the discussion yesterday? By superluminal, you mean just this argument. You don't mean that if I take that effective field theory and compute calculate the effective field theory two-point function of commutator outside my cone, I find the answer which is not zero within a by amount more than I'm certain to the effective field theory calculation.
So I guess if we, I'm not doing that. I mean, I'm doing what I said I did, but I guess what I would find is that the light cone here, I get a modified light cone. The light cone would be slightly widened by a perturbatively small amount.
Right, but the question is, because this, there's no translation invariant background, it's curved background.
Yes,
so
that's
the question
right.
Within the extent of background, does light cone bind to large enough extent?
Okay, well,
protons more than effective field theory?
Just wait.
No, just to see. Clarify your comment about what we were saying yesterday. Yesterday we were discussing these situations when within effective field theory one sees that light cone broadened by more than resolution of effective field theory.
I don't believe it is, no.
So here I don't think that's the case.
That's right.
Yeah,
I think so I agree with that.
In this sense, it's subluminal.
I think I agreed with both the two sides yesterday.
Okay. So to make the analogy here, in the discussion of yesterday, this is subluminal theory. This is not superluminal.
Sorry, one thing I don't understand is why omega goes to zero, because I thought that if I think
yeah,
the
yeah.
Two characteristics.
Yeah, yeah, geometric optics limit requires omega bigger than a curvature scale. That's a good point, so I'll answer that. I didn't think anyone would notice that. So, yeah, so it's omega going to zero. We'll see in a second. So this relates to what we were talking about yesterday. So just because we have some low energy or low frequency refractive index being less than one, we can't really infer directly from that that there's a violation of causality. I mean, we had this discussion yesterday during Andrew's talk. So causality arguments should really be couched in terms of sharp wavefronts, which need modes of high frequency. Of course, you can always ask, how high do they have to be? That is an issue which I won't address. But it's this high frequency behavior of the refractive index that is relevant, and that can't be calculated from the Drummond-Hatherell terms, which are just the lowest terms in the frequency expansion. The other thing we can try to do to think about causality violation is to build a kind of time machine using this effect. And generally this needs large boosts and or large curvatures along with sharp wavefronts. And then basically the point is you can't just terminate the effective theory with the Drummond-Hatherell terms. You've got to go beyond that. So in order to answer questions about causality, you've got to go beyond the lowest terms in the effective theory.
If you had a translational environment.
Okay, I don't. So,
yeah, but it's important. Again,
okay, well, maybe you can make that point afterwards, but I don't. I mean, I've got a curved background. In general, it will have some symmetries.
Right, yeah, but.
Okay, but it's not Minkowski space, otherwise, there wouldn't be any effect.
Yeah, but, yeah, so all what you say is correct. But,
yeah.
But the background is not translational environment.
So, if I were talking about a different theory, I might have a different effect.
Yeah, but your relationship.
Or no effect. Yeah, okay. Well, let me tell the story and then we'll try to draw these things together. But as, of course, Andrew mentioned in his talk, there is hope of getting some kind of causality argument by using dispersion relations to relate the infrared behavior of the refractive index to the ultraviolet behavior. So I'll set that up again. I'll go through that very, very quickly. But first of all, of course, we should think of this refractive index as really a response function or retarded Green's function. So this is the way to think about it. We've got this mode of the photon field coming in, this wavefront, and we're picking out a certain point, this point which I'll usually choose to be the origin in the coordinates, and we're calculating the refractive index at that point as a function of frequency. So usually x will be zero. So really what I'm doing is I'm calculating this response to the incoming wavefront. So this is the polarization tensor. So basically I'm doing a Fourier transform. Now, because I'm talking about a UV complete theory, it's just QED, we can expect that this polarization self-energy here to be causal. So the wavefronts that have come in, like the one I've shown here, which have the v-coordinate greater than zero, can have no causal influence at the point that I've chosen the origin. And that implies that the refractive index is analytic in the upper half plane, the usual argument about causality and pulling away the contour. So I won't go through that again because we talked about that yesterday. So if we assume that there is a consistent perturbative UV completion in this case, then we might expect the following things to hold. We might expect that this refractive index is analytic in the upper half plane, just mentioned that. We would also expect, because of hermeticity, that this real space Green's function here is real. So that implies a certain reality condition on the refractive index, this condition here, sort of real analyticity condition. Since the UV theory is just QED, the high frequency propagation must have speed one. So we expect the real part of the refractive index at infinite frequency to be one. And then on top of that, we would expect the optical theorem. So we would expect basically the propagation to be dispersive, meaning that the imaginary part of the refractive index should be positive. Of course, we're going to have to find a hole somewhere in these assumptions, but for the moment, let's accept them.
Well, I think I'm starting again related to what we discussed before. One wouldn't expect that because your background is not translational invariant. So you should talk not about the fraction index, but there is a curve which is a function of omega and p, and one should talk about analytic properties of that curve.
Well, what do you mean by p? I mean, because we're in curved space.
Yes,
you could, there is, you can't really do a momentum space picture here, the real,
well,
real space picture. I'm not going to be necessarily close to flat.
It's even more complicated. So just to say that, but it may be a bit too naive to expect that.
So, okay, if we agree there's going to be a hole somewhere in these assumptions, we agree. Okay. Yeah.
A technical question. Can you go back one slide?
Yep.
So, about the real part of n at infinity over 1. Usually, you assume the whole n of omega going to 1 at infinity in all complex directions, not just the real part. No?
Well, you're right. You're right. This is QED, so you expect the imaginary part to go to 0 as well. Yeah, yeah. Indeed, that will be the case.
But it's just a question. So we assume that for complex omega because we have to close the computer to infinity. Is there any physical reason why that is the assumption, because we have an intuition about whatever
this, this is just QED. So we expect the refractive indexes to be one high enough frequency.
The same, because we know the frequency data.
Yeah, QED high frequencies you're focusing in are, you know, the curvature doesn't matter, it's just QED in flat space.
Maybe this is what you're asking. There's this theorem, Kanazawa, somebody, that if a function along the real axis complex function dies away under reasonable conditions of the function, then it also dies away everywhere in the complex plane. And that's what all these integrals are based. So, yeah, I forgot the second note, I apologize.
But there's no particular assumption there. That is not the problem. Okay, so we know that we can then formulate the Kramers-Kronig dispersion relation, which I won't go through again because we did that yesterday, but it tells us that the real part of the refractive index at zero frequency, so the IR is all going on around the origin here, is equal to the real part at infinity, which is just one because it's QED, and then we've got the integral of the imaginary part. And if that's positive, so the optical theorem is satisfied, then of course we deduce that this real part of the refractive index at zero frequency would be greater than one. But Drummond-Hathrell says that, well, at least for one particular polarization of the photons, so actually this n has got indices on it that I'm suppressing, this real part is less than one. So what gives? So in curved space, of course, some of these assumptions are questionable. So rather than trying to pick apart those assumptions, let's do something better. Let's actually calculate this refractive index exactly. Well, at least part of it exactly, if that's quite the right word. In other words, let's sum up an infinite number of terms from an effective theory point of view. And the question is, can we do that? Is there a calculational window? And there is, where stationary phase or WKB methods are applicable. So I've already talked about the geometric optics approximation, where the frequency is large compared with the curvature. So let's look at this other limit, which, as you'll see in a second, is it's like the Penrose limit, or it will implement the Penrose limit, where the mass of the electron is much greater than the curvature scale. So what that does is, if we can calculate in this window, then we sum up an infinite number of terms which have the following functional form. So you can see that I've got these two ratios. This is an arbitrary function of these two ratios. One ratio is big, one is small, and so that dimensionless quantity can be small or large. So when I talked about omega going to zero, actually it's this dimensionless ratio that goes to zero in the low frequency limit. So that's what we're going to be able to do. We're going to be able to calculate F exactly. So we're summing up at least a subset of terms. Okay, so how does this stationary phase work? So I won't go through the calculation, I'll just give you a flavor. But basically what we're doing is we're calculating this Fourier transform of the self-energy, of the polarization. So that's a product of the propagators of the electron and positron against the incoming photon mode. So I'm integrating over x prime. So in the limits that I talked about, this integral over x prime has a saddle point, or a stationary phase point. And what it does is the following thing. So x here is the point that I'm talking about. My refractive index is defined at that point. So that's fixed. I'm integrating over x prime, and the stationary phase just says that x prime has to lie on the null geodesic through x, whose tangent vector is given by the derivative of this function of the incoming photon wavefront. So that's how the stationary phase works. And then something else happens because of this Penrose limit I talked about. Since the mass of the electron and positron is large compared with the curvature scale, if you like, this loop of the electron and positron, it doesn't explore the curvature very far. So the Compton wavelength of these particles here is much smaller than the scale over which the curvature varies, in which case we can approximate the full metric of the background by a metric that lies within this tubular neighborhood. And that's precisely the Penrose limit for that particular null geodesic that I've picked out. And the Penrose limit is a plane wave geometry. So in suitable coordinates, well, precisely the coordinates that I chose to start with that were adapted to describe the null congruence. So the plane wave geometry is this. The non-trivial bit is the fact that I've got a 2x2 matrix, I and J, again run 1 to 2, which is a function of this affine parameter, U. So in this limit, I can just work with these plane waves. Another point of view to take is I could just work with plane waves as examples of curved backgrounds if I wish. And then I don't need to do this procedure.
What is this refraction in this? Because again, even in translation environment background, in general, there will be some kernel, which is a function of omega and phi.
So well, if I'm working in real space, so I've got omega and x. Okay? So that's my refractive index.
So it's really a function of omega and x. And
yes.
Whatever condition there, it should be really.
Yeah, so I want to emphasize, yeah, the thing I'm calculating, you see, depends on this x. Okay. So I'm picking a point.
You shouldn't be satisfied, because is x dependence of n comes from the fact that the metric depends on x.
Yeah, so even in translation invariant case,
exactly.
N is a function of, the kernel is a function of omega and p. And it's important to keep dependence both of
I'm just working in... this is the refractive index. So I'm working in real space picture here. So this is the polarization tensor. It depends on real space x and x prime. Now, in flat space, you can Fourier transform everything. But in curved space, that's not a very convenient thing to do.
It answers my question, but it's not clear why there is any condition that this function is just a function of omega.
It's not, it's a function of x as well.
Yeah,
okay, but sometimes I won't show that dependence. Okay, so we've got these plane waves, and the great thing about plane waves is that propagators are WKB exact. So I don't want to go through this in too much detail, you probably know this stuff. So this would be a scalar propagator, of course electron and positron are spinners, but there's some generalization. So the propagator can be written in terms of real line formalism, a real time formalism, sorry, this capital T, in terms of two quantities, the geodesic interval, and then this Van Vleck-Moret determinant, which I will define in a second. Now, let's choose a particular example of a plane wave. They're the closest analog, if you like, to a constant background. They're the analog, for instance, of a constant electromagnetic background, if we were describing that example. That's where that 2x2 matrix is just a constant. It doesn't depend on U, and then I can diagonalize it. It's got two real eigenvalues, which can be positive or negative. So the sigmas that I write down, because it's sigma squared, can either be real or purely imaginary. Okay, and in particular, I'll focus on a conformally flat symmetric plane wave where these two parameters, sigma 1 and sigma 2, are the same. And then if I wish to apply the null energy condition to the background space-time, then these sigmas have to satisfy this condition. So in this case, the sigma squared, or sigma has to be real. Okay, so I'm sure you know this stuff. The geodesic interval is just the word line action for the geodesic that joins the two points, x and x prime. And so for our conformally flat plane wave, the one that we'll work with, that's the answer for the geodesic interval. The Van Vleck-Moret determinant tells you about the fluctuations about the world line, and that's given by the second derivative with respect to one end and, well, with respect to both ends of the geodesic interval. That defines a matrix. We take its trace, we stick it along some factors of the determinant of the metric, and for our conformally flat symmetric plane wave, that is the answer. Okay, so when you do this calculation, you do the saddle point analysis, you do the Gaussian integrals effectively. This is the final answer. I'm quoting it for the case-active scalar QED. We have a slightly more complicated expression for real QED. So this is the refractive index. It depends on where you are along the geodesic. In fact, it depends on which geodesic you've chosen. It depends on the frequency. And this is the expression. So we've got an integral over two parameters here, which are the two proper times, one of the electron, one of the positron, and I've written them in terms of an overall proper time and a Feynman parameter, C. And then there's a factor which involves the square root of the Van Vleck determinant, and then the second derivative of the geodesic interval. which give n, see n is actually a matrix. So in general, you can get birefringence. This thing can, different polarization states can behave in a different way. So for the simplest example, this conformally flat symmetric plane wave, all that stuff boils down to this. So this is the final result for the refractive index. And actually in this case, this refractive index doesn't depend on U at all because these symmetric plane waves have a symmetry, have a killing vector. So it doesn't depend on U at all. It just depends on the frequency. And we can take this and you can expand it in this thing here, which comes from these factors here. You can expand it in powers of T and do the T integrals. And then you can pick off the terms in the effective theory by looking at, you know, the terms that you get order by order in the frequency. So we're actually summing up an infinite number of terms in the effective theory. So it's important to look at the form of the result. For this symmetric plane wave, it depends on this this Van Vleck determinant, which has the following form. It has these functions that appear down here in the denominator, and they have poles. And it's these poles that are the important thing for the story here. So they have their origin in conjugate points. So what are conjugate points? Well, here's my null geodesic, and I'm sitting at x equals 0. Let me look at the spray of null geodesics that come out from this point in different directions, where it turns out that they focus if these sigmas here are real. I said, remember, the sigmas can be real or purely imaginary. So in the case that they're real, the spray focuses down onto the conjugate point. And because of the null energy condition, at least what there are two of these transverse directions giving sigma 1 and sigma 2, and at least one of them is focusing. So that's the thing about gravity. It's always net focusing. So at least one of these directions focuses down. Okay, so there are poles. So here's this integral again that I wrote down before for the conformally flat symmetric plane wave. What I didn't say is that because of these poles in the T integral here coming from the sine, there's a prescription here. You have to go round the poles in the right way, and that corresponds to integrating underneath the real axis. So the integrand in T has these conjugate point poles all the way along the real axis, and I integrate underneath. Now, I can, in this case, for this particular example, I can pull the contour down, so I'm integrating along the imaginary axis. There are no singularities along the imaginary axis. So this is a valid thing to do. So I rotate the contour, and then I get the following expression for the refractive index. And the important point now is it's completely real. So in fact, in this example, the imaginary part of the refractive index just vanishes. So that's important because when we got a list of assumptions, one of them was that the imaginary part was zero or positive. Well, this is an example where it's just zero. So that makes life particularly simple. But we can also look at the low frequency behavior here. And in fact, we already know from the Drummond-Hatherell result that the low energy behavior, the low frequency behavior is superluminal. So n is less than one. And we can just track, we can just plot this function, do these integrals numerically. Well, you don't need to do them numerically. But so you can plot the refractive index as a function of frequency. And it goes to one for large frequencies, as shown. So this is a particularly nice example then to actually interrogate the Kramers-Kronig relation. How did it end up being violated? Because we have everything we need. We have the refractive index as an analytic function. And it's a case where there's a superluminal propagation. So what is violated is that the refractive index is not analytic in the upper half plane, which was a bit surprising and scary at first. So it apparently is not causal. And we can see that explicitly if we go back to that integral form. So before I do the integral over T, this hyperbolic sine function here has poles up the imaginary axis. And when I do the T and the C integrals, it smears those poles into a cut. So actually there's a cut up the imaginary axis. Now your first thought is that cuts can be rotated away, that you know I can move onto the sheet here, onto the sheet, I can go along here and down onto the next sheet. So maybe this cut really isn't physical. But it actually has to be, because we also know from the reality condition that the refractive index satisfies, we know what the function is here. So we can analytically continue in both directions, and then at some point we get a discontinuity. So although you can move the cut, it has to be there. These two sides lie on different sheets. But the cut the discontinuity goes to zero fast enough at zero and infinity that you can still do the KK integral, as I've shown there. The new thing is that, well, the imaginary part of the refractive index is zero in this case, but now you pick up a discontinuity across the cut. And it's that is responsible for the fact the refractive index at zero free or low frequencies is less than one, even though at high frequencies it's equal to one. So now the question is, what are we going to do about this cut? What does it mean?
So in my crappy argument of yesterday, to get the retarded propagator, I would give that you needed the front velocity to be one, infinity, which you've got, but also the analyticity, the two conditions are necessary.
Yeah.
So you've got the front velocity being one, but now I'm worried that because you're not analytic, the retarded propagator is still not zero outside the line.
So, I mean, this is precisely what we were worried about. So this looks like a in-your-face violation of causality.
Right.
Okay, so now let's explain why that's not true. So this explains in a kind of mathematical sense why the Kramers-Kronig relation is, it's not really violated, it's modified. It's because analyticity in the upper half plane fails. And it actually means that when you calculate this Fourier transform of n of omega, so usually, if it's analytic, the Fourier transform would vanish for V greater than zero. That's the whole point. That's the causal behavior. Here it doesn't. It has some exponential behavior in V. So it's as if the wavefront has a bow wave that hits you first. But that's very puzzling because the light cone in this section with the null coordinates is just the same as in Minkowski space for this plane wave. So how can this thing affect here if it, you know, how can it do that?
Sorry, can I make a comment? So in fact, it should even be worse than this, because usually analyticity of N is associated with the existence of a retarded wave function in the sense that it vanishes before t equals zero, let alone the light cone.
Okay, so yeah, no, I totally agree. So let me tell the story and then we can pick up the pieces. So I'm almost done. So the wavefront seems to have an effect before it arrives. I mean, that's essentially just what you said. How can that be true? So is there a breakdown of causality? Well, there can't be, because this is just QED. There can't be a breakdown in causality. So there must have been a subtlety that we missed. And the subtlety is caused by the fact that I'm talking about these rays going along null geodesics, but really I've got a wavefront, which is extended in the transverse directions. And the point is, the existence of these conjugate points imply, as I'll show in a second, that the light cone in the transverse directions is actually complicated. So really, I can't just think of this as being a one-dimensional Fourier transform. I have to think about the fact that it's really a four-dimensional problem. So recall that the refractive index is schematically, I'm integrating this polarization tensor with x prime over the past light cone. That's because this is a retarded Green's function of the incoming photon. So what's the light cone, at least in this plane wave background? Well, it's the points, if I choose x to be at zero, it's points where x prime, the geodesic interval is zero. So that just gives me a fairly simple expression in a plane wave background. So let's plot it. So it looks like this. So this is the point that I'm fixing. I'm looking at the light cone of that point, the backward light cone, and it looks like this. So these lines here are actually null geodesics that I'm going, that I'm following backwards, and they all focus down on the next conjugate points. I mean, all this can, you know, just carries on repeating. They all focus down onto there, actually, except the one that happens to slide down in that direction, a set of measure zero. So they all focus on this point. Okay, so just hold that picture in your mind. Well, you don't have to, because here it is again. So actually, when you stare at this, you start wondering what's inside and what's outside the light cone. So here's our point again. Now, if we're near here, we know what's happening. These points are space-like. They're outside. Points inside the light cone are sort of in that cone there, because that's just like Minkowski space. But as we follow it back, these points are inside. These points are inside. But here comes the subtlety that there's a forbidden plane here, forbidden in the sense there are no geodesics that connect a point here to X, because the geodesic interval is infinite. And that plane can also separate being in and out. So usually we think of the light cone doing that, but this plane can also do that. So actually inside the light cone sort of has this big area going up here. Of course, this is inside the light cone again. This is outside, and these two regions here are actually separated by this forbidden area, this plane, which is U equals or whatever it is. Yeah, so this is the U coordinate along here. So that's really the answer. In flat space-time, a wavefront with V prime or V coordinate greater than zero indicated here never intersects the backward light cone of my point, because the light cone, you know, is this concave thing here. We just know it never intersects. But in this case, my wavefront comes along and it actually intersects the light cone here. So this is inside the light cone. So signals, if you like, can get from there to there before this, well, this guy never arrives at this point in time. It only arrives at that point somewhere up there. So that's what creates the bow wave. It's the fact that when we follow things backwards, the light cone does something a bit complicated, and our incoming wavefront actually hits it. So signals can reach x equals zero, and that's what allows everything to happen. But you seem to have superluminal behavior, but it's a causality violation, but you don't. Okay. So the Drummond-Havel effect in the gravitational background shows that superluminal propagation in a low energy effective theory need not be inconsistent with UV completion. And that's because the light cone is a very convoluted object. It has cusps and catastrophes and focal points and all kinds of complicated things in general. So apparently space-like separated incoming wavefronts could have intersected with the light cone in the past. It depends on the geometry. But the important thing is that because gravity is net attractive, that you'll always get these conjugate points, at least in one of the transverse directions. And in fact, that's exactly the same effect that lies behind the singularity theorems, the fact that gravity is net attractive. So attempts to invoke the KK relation is not wrong, it just needs to be reassessed because of these subtle geometric effects. So that's all I have to say, thanks. Yeah, yeah.
But it's
any background has at least one superluminal polarization.
Right, but then that one was a homogeneous background, if I remember.
Yeah, the cosmological background is fine.
Yeah. But then that was kind of, at least what we've been discussing was that once you get characteristics or inhomogeneous backgrounds, that doesn't necessarily mean danger. You can have to check further. What you're saying, of course, is consistent, like UV description of that. But on homogeneous backgrounds, I mean, intuitively, at least, you should be able to accumulate that signal in the context of effective field theory.
So,
and that's what I'm kind of puzzled. I don't know.
That's one of the time dependent, right? So it's not really in some sense.
What?
That one isn't time dependent.
This plane wave.
No, right.
That's even not really in some sense.
Sorry, I can't hear that.
No, that makes it even more tricky, right? So there's time dependent.
No, I understand, but still, there must be.
So you can't even make football. Again, you should study the 2-point function carefully.
So, I mean, we can consider any background, but I haven't considered in detail with the story of the light cone that particular case. So that would be interesting to do. I mean, you're still worried about this issue that if you have this superluminal propagation at low frequency, you could make some kind of time machine.
Well, I shouldn't be able to. Well,
yeah.
I think we all agree on that. QD, I shouldn't be able to, but what's the story?
You start with a limit, there is up a limit on the frequency in which you can start, right? And then it gets redshifted. And it gets redshifted, the distortion effect becomes smaller and smaller, right? So that's what should save you.
So you're saying that if these effects take a Hubble time to develop, then you have to analyze.
Well, of course, these effects are really perturbatively small in the case of QED. So in order to make them large, you'd have to make the expansion, I guess, very, very fast.
So there is another effect that I don't know if it matters, but in homogeneous backgrounds, I know the case of, say, high spins, so spin 3.5, irrelevant operators play a role. I mean, if you just keep the first few terms in your expansion, just the terms that are linear in the curvature, this RFF, you may get superluminal propagation. But that would be the same in spin 3.5 if you only kept the standard Lagrangian and maybe a Pauli term. But at least for homogeneous backgrounds, you know that you can add a set of irrelevance, actually an infinite set, that makes the propagation completely within the light cone. So the question of whether you are in the light cone or out cannot be decided just by looking at the first few irrelevance.
That's something you see from the power.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this means that when you actually take a finite box, et cetera,
you can use it from looking at the more energy purposes. It's very nice extrapolation, but I think you agree that kind of it's within effective field theory, just doing careful calculation within low energy effective field theory.
What I've done?
Yes.
No, I haven't. I mean, I've done a calculation in QED. So I mean, the effective field theory, it's an asymptotic expansion.
Okay.
But I've not done that. I've done the QED calculation, and then you can expand it.
Right.
So.
I mean, as you're saying, for spin 3.5, if you take just the spin 3.5 coupled to an electromagnetic field, constant field strength, and you compute the 2-point function with the Alasberg-Zwanziger actually before, Sudarshan and company, you get non-zero results. You add a host of terms that are higher powers of f, so what you would call an irrelevance, and you get the 2-point function that vanishes at zero. This question has to answer this question.
But then it must be that you already see from that first truncation that potential, irrelevant terms are of the same order as the one that you use.
Absolutely.
Right.
That means that from the very beginning you cannot really make any statement. I mean, if you're saying that all your effect, superluminal effect, I mean, not you, but whoever's saying, superluminal is sitting on the operate with the correction which is order one, obviously you cannot make any statement. Right?
But yeah, I don't know how to take it. I mean,
you have to check if the next ones are also important.
Well, if it's power counting, I mean, it's okay. So that's what we're doing.
As you know, when you have superluminality, there is always a frame in which the effects are large. So, yeah, I mean, you have to think about it. I mean, you always have a frame in which the speed of propagation is infinite,
right,
and the 2-point function is not zero everywhere, right?
Yes.
Order one. But still, I mean, I would only be able to answer your question in specific examples. If you look at the Lagrangian, you see that there is the potential for fixing this problem with higher order operators.
But let me ask you, sorry, you went into a different direction.
No, carry on.
So the field strength, the field strength in that example is of the order of the cutoff? No? It's way below?
Could be as small as you want.
But then how come the relevant terms are helping?
Yeah, this effective Lagrangian approach may be tricky, right? So
there must be other parameters.
Well, you know, if you want to consider, if you want to do an analysis exactly of the delay time, etc., you discover that you need that if you truncate your set of irrelevance up to a point, right, you can make the effects smaller than the cutoff of your theory on an arbitrarily large box. So, okay, let's say you have a finite box, finite time, not really infinite homogeneous configuration. You have infinite homogeneous configurations to avoid non-causality, you need an infinite set of terms. Now, if you set limits for the time of propagation and the size of the domain where your fields are constant, then yes, you discover that at some point, after you have added a certain number of irrelevance, then the effects become too small. But again, these effects exist. The problem of Veros-Weinziger is that this effect exists for arbitrarily weak fields. So non-causality are there. It's not only strong field effects.